This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And today I am so honored to welcome to Joy on Paper, Frederick Branfun. I hope I pronounced it right. Frederick Branfun. The name of his book is Intimate Strangers, and he is a brilliant scholar. His book, Intimate Strangers, A History of Jews and Catholics in the City of Rome, is one of the most, for a scholarly book, it is one of the loveliest reads, and I am so honored to welcome you to the program today.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show. Thank you so much for that introduction.
Really. You know, I mean, I love scholarly books. That's my main focus in life. So I tell you, when I got this book and I started reading it, I said, oh my goodness, it just, the writing is so clear, so beautiful, and everybody who is interested in history should read this book because you cover a very important time and over many, many, many years, and a subject that sort of reaches out and has tentacles all around the world. So tell us about Intimate Strangers, and it's just, I think it's an amazing book.
Well, thank you very much. The book really is about the history of Jews and Catholics in the city of Rome. And it starts, really before the Catholic Church was established in 139 BCE, when there was a Jewish community in Rome, very small and fairly obscure. We don't know too much about it. And the book traces the history of the relationship between Jews and Catholics up until roughly today, when I put my pen down. And so there's quite a bit of time covered there. I enjoyed every minute of it when I was reading about it and writing about it. And I put together the book according to a certain theme. And the theme is that these two communities, the Jewish community, a small community in Rome, and the Catholic community, which grew to be, of course, an international organization, but was centered in Rome, lived together for roughly 2,000 years. And, of course, there was time when it was quite an adversarial relationship. There were Talmud burnings, and there was ghettoization, and the Jews were oppressed during that time, in those times. But there were other times, when, if you looked at how they related to each other, it was almost like a family snapshot. And they treated each other as family. They couldn't be family. Both Jewish law and Catholic law forbade Jews and Catholics from marrying, but they talked about each other as if they were family. And I think I say something about that they bump up against the limits of family. And over the years, this relationship developed. And like any family, as I said before, it was dysfunctional from time to time. But during World War II, what I noticed, when the chips were really down and the Jews of Rome were in deadly peril, many, many Catholic institutions and families stepped up to the plate and saved thousands of Jews. And then after World War II, there was a real reconciliation between Jews and Catholics. And on the cover of the book, there's a picture of Pope John Paul II and Elio Saas, who is a former... It was the former chief rabbi of Rome.
Well, it is. I love that picture. When I said that it has so much meaning, because when we're talking about Jews and how they've traveled all over the world, they're scattered all over the world, and when we focus on what went on in Rome, because it was a center point for so much of Jewish life, it really has touched Jews all over the world. And I myself have been, of course, to Rome many times. I love it. I've been to the ghetto. So explain, how is there still some place called a ghetto, which most people will think is a word nobody uses anymore?
Yes, well, you know, it's where the people call it the ghetto. They do. They call it the ghetto. Of course, it's not a ghetto anymore, but it's where the ghetto once was. You know, Rome was a walled city. It was a city surrounded by a wall. And in 1555, Pope Paul IV decreed that all Jews in Rome should live in this, in a restricted area that was itself surrounded by an inner wall. And Jews could live in that ghetto. They had to. They were able to go out and work in the other areas of Rome during the day. But at night, when the sun went down, they had to be locked inside the ghetto. And of course, when they went out to work during the day, their only job that was allowed them was rag picking. That is to say, collecting secondhand cloth and making it into mattresses and pillows and maybe some shoddy clothing as well. But now, of course, the ghetto was the longest-lived ghetto in Rome. It was the longest-lived ghetto in Europe. It was founded in 1555, dismantled in 1870. So there was quite a bit of time, hundreds of years, when Jews were forced to live in this ghetto. But now, it is just an area in Rome. If you get in a cab, you ask them to take you to the ghetto, they know exactly where to take you. But, of course, it's an area in Rome which is a center of Jewish life in Rome. The central synagogue is there, and a great many of the kosher eateries are there. Things like that.
Yeah,
it's a wonderful place to be.
Oh, it is. It is. when you go there, the food is great. It's absolutely wonderful. Now, you know, for, as you said, Jews were limited in what they were supposed to be doing, but Jews did a lot in Rome. Tell us about some of the interactions on the financial side and how Jews worked within those walls, and with the arts, the relationship to the artists of that period, long ago.
Yes, first of all, prior to the institution of the ghetto, Jews lived all over Rome, and that was, you know, in the 1400s, 1300s, and they were very much a part, and wanted to be a part, of the intellectual life of Italy in the 1300s and the 1400s. And, they were very familiar with Italian poetry, Dante's Inferno. They were very familiar with the work of Michelangelo, Michelangelo's Moses that was sculpted in Rome. And they were able to get Catholic artisans to make the metal and gold, silver fixings for the synagogue. And one of those persons was Benvenuto Cellini, who was a very famous artist. So they were totally involved. And in fact, there are certain Jews, wrote their own Jewish version of the Divine Comedy. And Jews translated the Divine Comedy into Hebrew and things like that. And that was the cultural side of it. Now, in terms of the financial side, of course, Jews were permitted to lend money. They were Catholics, by the way. This is a gray area, really, in any society, and especially, let's talk about the 1500s, capitalism was something that was on the horizon, and the world was turning from a feudal society to a capitalistic society, and people needed cash, and sometimes small amounts of cash, sometimes large amounts of cash. Jews did not supply large amounts of cash to anyone. If you wanted to send a boat to the New World, Jewish money was not financing that expedition. But if you had a farm or if you had a dairy or something like that, Jews would finance that, their bridge loans or whatever it is, allow you to pawn or pledge some of your items, and they were able to do that. Now, this, of course, was regulated by papal law, and on the one hand, the Pope, did not want it to happen at all, but what we say is that the Pope really allowed liquidity, in terms of financial liquidity, more than he hated lending. So they were able to do so. The number of banks that they called banks, we wouldn't call them banks today, we really call them pawn shops. But the number of pawn shops or banks in the ghetto was regulated by papal order and was negotiated because Jews wanted there to be more banks, the Pope wanted there to be less banks, and this had to be negotiated, and eventually the Pope then established his own bank in Rome, but they didn't provide any interest. If you put your money in a papal bank in Rome, it was probably safe, but it's no interest accrued. In a Jewish bank, interest accrued. So the business model for the Catholic banks in Rome needed a little tweaking at a certain point.
Well, you write about all of this. So, with scholarly writing, sometimes it really is like difficult for the average person to read it. But this book is so much fun and filled with anecdotes and stories and just information that people have not heard about. And we don't have very much time. Actually, I'm going to invite you back because I need more time with you. I love this book. And I want to promote it as a wonderful book for everybody to read, but also especially for authors, because they really will find... I mean, this is like a source of material for... I could come out with like 20 novels just based on this book. Just let's quickly talk a little bit about the Arch of Titus and the Jewish catacombs, and we will then finish today, but I'm going to have you back, okay?
Well, I would love to come back. How could I not want to come back? Look at this thing. How could I not want to come back? Of course I'll come back.
Okay. So talk about the Jewish catacombs.
Well, the catacombs are burial sites, and we take it for granted, but, in Rome at the time, and we're talking about the 2nd century A.D. or C.E., and the 3rd century A.D. or C.E., the Jews were allowed to have their own burial ground. It was just something that said, of course they could have it, and they did. When we say burial grounds, they were buried in caves. The caves were rock cut. They were man-made. There was a hill here or a hill, there are none of them surrounding the city of Rome, and they would, with the axe and chisel, they would cut passageways through the rock, and along the passageways there would be burial niches where Jewish men and women were buried, and there was usually a sign or something that allowed you to see their name and or what their profession was, who their parents were, things like that, these Jewish catacombs were rediscovered. They were abandoned about the 4th century CE, but they were rediscovered in the 19th century, in the early 20th century. Unfortunately, you can't go to them. They are, I was very lucky to be given a private tour of the catacombs, but the average visitor to Rome can't go. One of the catacombs is being refurbished. And it is refurbished and, restored so that tourists can go there. And this is the Torlonia catacombs. They're covered with wall paintings and inscriptions, and all the remains of the humans have been removed. But these catacombs in Torlonia are underneath the Torlonia Palace. And the Torlonia Palace was where the fascist dictator Mussolini lived during his time as a dictator, and he lived right on top of a Jewish burial ground.
Wow.
Sort of incredible. It's sort of incredible, but he did.
Well, that's what I'm saying. There's so much. I think right there I could write a novel about somebody haunting Mussolini. I mean, we could just do a fantastic novel.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think so. That's why I think this book is so relevant and so important for people to read. And anybody going to Rome, you must read this book because you'll want to carry it around with you as you know, probably Kindle version because it's a heavy book, but it is beautifully written, really, really fantastic. So, Frederick Branfon, that's the right pronunciation.
Okay.
So you're going to come back because what I want you to do is talk about not just your book, but how you did the research because you are a fantastic researcher. Okay.
Absolutely. Please, I would love to.
Okay.
I would love to give credit. Love to give credit to all the people I read and enjoyed reading.
Good.
Absolutely.
Well, I will send you an invitation. And meanwhile, people, get this book, Intimate Strangers, A History of Jews and Catholics in the City of Rome. It's by Frederick Branfon. It is a great book to read. I mean, you will not ever think that you're reading a scholarly book because, boy, oh boy, when you get into it, you can't stop reading. I just wanted to know more and more and more. So thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today, Frederick, and we'll have you back soon, okay?
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye now. Wow, you know, this is a lucky day for me. I get to talk about, first of all, I got to talk about Rome, which is a city I love, and now I get to talk about New York City with somebody who really knows New York City. Lucien Bloch has written a fantastic book, personal essays called Whistling in the Dark. And I am so happy to welcome you to Joy on Paper. Lucien.
Hello, Joy. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, thank you. Well, you know, my name is Patsy with a Z.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I just wanted to...
You're Patsy, right. Yeah. I'm sorry. I was looking at the wrong piece of paper.
No, that's okay. The reason I'm saying it is that I thought you would find it interesting that Jimmy Hoffa gave me my name.
Really?
Really? I used to sit on his knee when I was a little baby, and he used to call me Patsy. And so...
that's quite a recommendation.
Exactly. And because I was thinking about a certain New Yorker who played him in a movie, and that was not Jimmy Hoffa. Jimmy Hoffa was so sweet, and he was Midwestern. He was not from Brooklyn. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Well, I don't know much about him except that his burial place is a mystery.
Well, maybe not. Maybe not to me because I was still in contact with him when he was in prison. So, so you never know.
No.
I might come out with a book, but I will not be able to come out with a book as good as your book. I mean, personal essays, Whistling in the Dark. You've given us New York. As I didn't know so many things about New York that are in your book. And then, of course, you've also given us Vienna because you write so beautifully about your mother. So let's start a little bit with the New York stories. Because, for example, I didn't know about Lake Manhattan. I knew there's a lake, and I didn't know sort of the history of it. So all these little tidbits that you just make New York come alive.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I've been here all of my conscious life anyway, and it's good material for me. I enjoy New York, and I enjoyed writing about it.
And you know it so well, and write so it's very compelling when you're writing. I can see you so visual. I can see what you're writing about, and it's really exciting.
Well, thank you. I try to be as accurate as possible, but still imaginative about the metaphorical stuff. So I love writing personal essays. I started out writing novels, fiction, and it just didn't work for me. I mean, they were pretty good books, but I didn't. 40 years later, I needed to rewrite a lot of the stuff. so I found a different form for it, which allowed me to be much more, it was much looser in a way than fiction, because it was just what was rolling around in my head. I didn't have to do it in the form of another character or a plot or anything like that. It's a very forgiving form, the personal essay.
It is, and we get to go into your head. I think it's a beautiful mind you've got.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I don't know. Yeah, I do. I'm obsessed with language, as comes through in the book, I think. And it's mainly because I didn't... When I first started school, when I was 5 years old, my parents sent me to school. Wasn't until I walked into the classroom that I realized I didn't speak the language of everybody else. We spoke only French at home. I don't know why. My parents, who both spoke perfect English, kept English away from us. And it was a very difficult difficult first year of school, I have to say. Yeah.
So tell us where you started school.
It was a progressive school across the street from where we lived, which I think is why they chose to send me there, because it certainly didn't, it wasn't anything like their own values and ideas about behavior and all of that. But that's where I went, didn't get a very good education, actually flunked freshman English in college. But things have changed since then. I'm not going to flunk English again.
No, I don't think so. Somewhere along the line, you learn how to write, because I have to tell people that you had a column in the New York Times. You've done such marvelous writing and award-winning writing. Part of it, I think, you like poetry.
I started out writing poetry, like many adolescents. But I didn't really stick with it. About halfway through college, I stopped. Although I had some very good role models at Wellesley, professors. Richard Wilbur was one. But it didn't do it for me. It was almost too fragile a form. So I started writing a novel. For my children, I thought it would be a record of my upbringing in New York, and it turned out a little differently. And then I wrote a bunch of short stories, and finally, I found the personal essay, that very, very forgiving form.
Well, you know, when we're thinking about New York nowadays, the changes that you've seen over the years...
Tremendous.
I don't know. When you look back at them, I was recently looking back, doing some work about, doing some research about the Automat. And so I was looking at some old, documentaries, old videos, and how nice the people looked. I mean, the streets were crowded. You know, Fifth Avenue was crowded, but all the men are wearing suits and the women wearing hats.
And a lot of the men are wearing hats too.
Oh yes, yeah.
Oh, I used to love the Automat. That was a very special treat that my father took us to once in a blue while, and it was amazing. It was just. Imagine the whole choice that we had, which we never had at home, of course. You ate what was on the table. But I missed parts of New York. But, the Upper West Side has retained a lot of its character. It's still a very mixed community and very lively, very bustling streets. And... It's an enclave of the old world in New York.
With great restaurants.
With pretty good restaurants, yeah.
I know. As I said, even simple things like Lake Manhattan, which I didn't even know it had a name. Tell my listeners about it. Why is it there?
Well, it's not a lake. it was originally called Manahatta, Lake Manahatta. It was not a lake. It's a reservoir that was created during the Civil War, and it was used to provide water for New York. And then there had been a reservoir on the site of the public library on 42nd and 5th. But that gave water downtown. But New York moved uptown. It's still kind of moving uptown. And they needed a new reservoir. So they built one during the Civil War and on the site of an old lake. So they called that first reservoir Manahatta, which is the old name of the island of Manhattan. Hello?
Yeah, go on.
So it was eventually recognized, the way I recognize it, as an urban treasure. And a lot of people who visit New York come to visit the reservoir because you get views that are incredible. You know, you see skyscrapers across the water.
Well,
I actually walk around the reservoir every single morning before I sit down to write.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's fantastic. I mean, one of the, of course, wonderful things about living in New York, and when I, you know, growing up in northern Michigan, I used to dream of living either in England or, you know, London or New York. I landed up in England, but the museums and the cultural life, that it's just at your fingertips there.
Yes, it is. It is. And not, if you take advantage of it, of course, but it is there and it's not going away.
We hope.
We hope. Well, eventually electronic everything, right? But at the moment, it's still live.
So you remember when they built, like, the MoMA? You remember? You've been there long enough to see?
Yeah, but I didn't see the Museum of Modern Art until it was well established as a new building that was built in the 30s, actually, a little before my museum going time. But I used to stand online when I was a teenager, late in my teenage. I used to go to the movies there to stand online waiting to get into the theater and see who looked interesting.
like Radio City Music Hall. Did you?
That's right. Yeah, but that was expensive, and I used to have my parents' Museum of Modern Art membership card, so it didn't cost me anything.
Oh, that's nice. So, when I think of New York, I think of all the times that I was there. Of course, we went to the theater a lot. It was so wonderful in those days to go to the theater. Yul Brynner. I remember when we were there and saw the original version. Did you see a lot of theater?
No. I wasn't taken to. Yes, when I was older, but not as a young child. I was taken to one movie in my childhood, and that was Bambi. And it scared me to death. I don't know why they call that a children's story. The first thing that happens is the mother is shot.
I know. I thought it was a terrible. I couldn't stand it myself. But one thing I do want to talk about a little bit. Again, it's always time constraint. But let's talk a little bit about your mother, because you write so beautifully about her.
Well, she was a difficult mother when I was young and through my adolescence, because she was quite strict. But later on, when I started to have children myself, my views changed a little bit. She was a She's a very hard number to follow, I have to tell you. Very glamorous, very social, many things that I am not. But I got very, yes, when she was sick for so long before she died, I did revise my view of her. And yeah, and I mean, she always did stress the Vienna background much more than my father did, his Belgian one. So, if you know, you grow up with the parents you get, you don't choose them.
Well, you know, I did like how you wrote about the Vienna, because of I've been also to Vienna many times, and the Jewish life in Vienna was so vibrant, and I can see how difficult it was to lose that.
Oh yes, and she's not the only one. There's everybody who came from Vienna and had to leave it feel very much the same way about it, that it was a pearl of cities and that nothing else can quite measure up, not even Paris.
No, I know, exactly. And we have, in my own synagogue, we have people who come from Vienna, and it's the same thing. It is something, it is for them, it is the shining city, much more than Paris, because it was so cultural, and the Jewish community was so very active there, of course, partly thanks to the Rothschilds and all of the other families there, but the whole cultural aspect of it, it was hard for them to come here.
Oh, very, very, yeah, and I think that's why they, particularly on the west side of New York in the 50s, there were a lot of Jewish refugees because it was a hospitable place for them. And they did stick together, those Viennese ones.
Yeah, they had I don't know, perhaps it's the music in their soul that Vienna does to you.
Yeah, I guess that's a good part of it.
It is. Yeah. It really is. There's something when you spend time in Vienna that even today, there's that music. Something gets into you. And, of course, the goulash, too, helps. And the schnitzel.
Not to mention all those wonderful coffee houses the newspapers on sticks hanging there.
I love those. I love those. For anybody who wants, it's such, and they still have it. The last time I was there, they still had those coffee houses. And to have a cold day in Vienna and to be eating goulash, there's nothing better, really.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today, Lucy.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I think your book is, I had earlier another book, another author, and I was telling him, you know, he wrote a book about Jews in Rome. And this book, your book, is a perfect book for all writers to really get a feeling for New York City, because you write so wonderfully, and a great, just a source. I mean, lots of ideas, lots of stories in there, and you've done a wonderful job, and I just want to thank you so much. And it's called Whistling in the Dark, Personal Essays. It's available online. I don't know if you're on... Do you have
it's on Amazon and on Barnes & Noble, both online.
Both. And it's Lucien Bloch, and it's B-L-O-C-H. Really fantastic book, and I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay. Well, you're fantastic. Just fantastic.
Okay. Goodbye.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now. Okay, now I get to turn to somebody who, well, he's a Florida guy, and I'm so excited about this book. Carlton? Is Carlton there? Carlton Ward. Hi, Carlton.
Hey, Patsy. How are you?
Okay. Well.
How are you today?
I'm here in Clearwater, Florida. I don't know where you are. Somewhere in Florida?
I'm across the bay in Tampa. You're in my native land. I grew up in Clearwater.
My goodness. Why didn't you come across the causeway? You could be here.
I could have done this in real life.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. Oh, they should have told me, because I would love to meet you here. And the name of your book is Path of the Panther, New Hope for Wild Florida. So, I mean, this is just a perfect book for us.
I hope so. This is a Florida story that I think can resonate in other states and other countries, but this is about our state animal, Florida panther, and what it means and what it needs for the protection of wild Florida.
Well, I think most people wouldn't know that the panther is the state animal of Florida. They're all thinking about alligators, but the panther is really a fantastic animal, and ours here in the state of Florida is very special.
Absolutely. This is it's a story of hope, because, you know, the panther, for people who aren't picturing it, it's a tawny brown-colored animal, kind of the color of a white-tailed deer. It's a cousin to the mountain lion and the cougar from out west. They're all pumas, but it's the last puma and the last big cat surviving east of the Mississippi River. Back in the 1960s, it was discovered that we still had panthers surviving down in the Everglades. And it's because these swamplands were so wild and inhospitable that panthers survived and persevered the persecution and habitat loss that wiped them out of existence everywhere else east of the Mississippi River. So now Florida is home to this amazing comeback story, where through conservation efforts, through the Endangered Species Act from the 1970s, panthers have recovered to nearly 200. And now they're perched on the brink of recovery if we can protect enough land for them to move back to historic territory elsewhere in the state.
When you say historical territory, where? North of where?
Well, 200 years ago, there were panthers all over the Florida Peninsula, as well as Georgia and Alabama and the Carolinas. And so, for the past 50 years, the breeding population where the females live has been from Fort Myers and south, below the Caloosahatchee River. And one of the main characters of this book, and the main characters of also a new film called Path of the Panther that just came out through National Geographic on Disney Plus and on Hulu, is a female panther who is the first documented north of the Caloosahatchee River since 1973. Scientists discovered her with their trail cameras and with a track back in November of 2016, and allowed me to set up my professional camera traps nearby and get photographs of this beautiful and inspiring female panther who had swum that river to set up a new territory in the northern Everglades for the first time in nearly 50 years.
Well, when we're talking about setting up cameras, you spend a lot of time in the Everglades being very quiet and waiting to see a panther.
I've done my share of that, and I've also recognized that no matter how long I wait there, I'm never going to see a panther often enough to get the pictures needed for this book or for the National Geographic magazine story or for the film. And so what I did was work with a tool called the camera trap. I made these custom studios with a professional camera and a waterproof box firing multiple flashes connected with an infrared trigger. You put it on the trail and try to predict where a panther may come through. And when it does, it trips the infrared beam and takes its own picture. That's the technique that provided most of the panther pictures you will see in the book. Some of those pictures took 2 years of effort in one spot. There are a few that took 5 years of camera trapping a single trail to get that picture that you see in the book.
Wow. Now, for panthers, what's their life like down there? I've only been to the Everglades once, so I'm not sure. I didn't go deep into the Everglades. So if it's deep into the Everglades, are they fairly safe that there aren't people out there? There's certainly not allowed to hunt any panthers.
Well, you know, I can only speculate what it's like to be a Florida panther. But there is still a lot of open space for them. There's big public lands in the southern part of Florida. There's 4 million acres of contiguous public land around Everglades National Park and the lands to the north. And panthers do well there. They do very well on cattle ranches and citrus groves and timberlands. And so, you know, there's space for panthers, and they can also coexist with people. There are panthers on the eastern edge of Naples who are, you know, in and near the subdivisions of Golden Gate Estates and other areas, and you do get conflicts with people. They'll eat hobby livestock or pets sometimes in people's backyards if they're left unprotected, which creates conflict. But there's also a huge opportunity for coexistence, because what a panther needs is enough habitat where they can find some deep woods to have a den, and they need food to eat. And their preferred food is the white-tailed deer, but they'll eat feral hogs and raccoons and all kinds of wildlife. But as long as there is habitat and space and food, the panther can survive and it can recover. And that can happen not just in southern Florida, but it can be up in central Florida, Ocala National Forest, the pine woods of north Florida and the Florida Panhandle, the Appalachian Mountains. Panthers would do fine returning to all those places where they used to live if we give them a path and if we decide we can coexist.
And that's a big decision. Not everybody is welcome to the idea. I mean, I think that exactly as you say, we can coexist. I come from northern Michigan. We step outside of our door and we could have a bear. We have certainly mountain lions up there. So we coexist, and rarely do we have, you know, any problems. It's funny, I live right here in Clearwater area, and one evening I came out to the garage, underground garage, and I looked over and I saw what first looked like a dog. And I realized it's not a dog, because we don't have dogs running around here without leashes. And it was a coyote, and it was right here, right in my parking lot.
That's amazing. Yeah, coyotes are remarkably adept at surviving in urban spaces. Panthers need a little bit more land and a little bit more wild space. But you're right. It's all about coexistence. And we in Florida have accepted that alligators are among us, and we could accept that panthers are among us too. But really, the best thing we can do is continue protecting the Florida Wildlife Corridor, and that means helping farmers and ranchers who own big tracts of land who don't want to develop them to have financial resources to keep farming and ranching through conservation easements and other solutions. And by doing that, we will protect enough wide open green space that keeps panthers further from people. And that will be good for panthers and good for us. Of course, there'll be development and potential conflict along the edges, but the more of the Florida Wildlife Corridor we can protect as big, wide, connected green space, the better it's going to be for everybody.
Absolutely. Now, panthers don't have any sort of enemies, other animals that prey on them, do they? How about the boa constrictor down there in the Everglades?
The pythons in the Everglades.
Oh, pythons, yeah.
Haven't had any documented conflict with the panther itself. I think that it is possible that a python could eat a panther kitten if the den is left unattended. I think an adult panther would eat a python if they came across each other. But there is a connection there, and the pythons are decimating the small mammal population, so far fewer raccoons and other fur-bearing animals that the panthers need for their food. Fortunately, however, the pythons have been primarily in the wet areas of Everglades National Park and the River of Grass and those wetter southern spots. And the panther prefers the uplands where it can find them, and so there's not a direct overlap with their territories right now.
Well, I think I've seen some pictures of you walking in the Everglades. Do the pythons worry you?
I've never really encountered a python. I do carry a knife, typically, just in case. But, no, I mean, the most dangerous thing I do or have done in all this work is drive my car to get to these places. Because once you're out in the wilderness, you're being vigilant. You're traveling with another person. You're using a walking stick when you're walking through waist-deep water. So there's an alligator down there. It knows you're coming before you step right into it. And, you know, we haven't had any real problem. So I think there's a fear of the unknown that goes along with these places, but once you spend as much time in them as I have, you fall in love with them and realize that they're these amazing sanctuaries for wildlife and people who are adventurous and go visit them.
Well, you look like you're home. I've seen some photos of you in the Everglades, and you're always smiling, so you look so happy.
Yeah, some of my best times are when I'm standing waist-deep in water. It's really a privilege to be connected to these wild places and to then be able to be a voice for their protection through my photography, through the storytelling, through the partnerships with the many organizations that fight for their protection.
And of course,
that's what it's all about. It's about, yeah.
Yeah, and you started, of course, this whole conservation of the panthers. I think you started an organization a while back, and of course National Geographic is fantastic, and all of the work for over 100 years that they've been doing in conservation. We owe so much, I think, to National Geographic all over the world, particularly in the United States, because Nat Geo has always been there talking about the importance of protecting the land and protecting animals.
That's absolutely right. I'm very thankful to be a National Geographic explorer and photographer and to be able to wield that brand, because when we brought the Florida Wildlife Corridor story to Tallahassee through the story of the Florida panther, lawmakers paid attention, and it's because it was in National Geographic magazine, and it's a rare unifying brand this day and age. It's not like the New York Times versus Fox News versus MSNBC. It's a brand and a story that brings people together around issues. And I'm very proud to be with National Geographic. I'm also very thankful to be with my own team here in Florida, WildPath. We're an organization like National Geographic that uses storytelling to advocate for conservation, and WildPath helped create the Path of the Panther Project with National Geographic and other local partners that help share this story, not just with public audiences, but with the lawmakers who ultimately are making the decisions to protect these places.
Well, if you ever want to do a PSA for your organization, I would be happy to play it here on Joy on Paper, because I believe in National Geographic and I believe in the kind of work that you're doing. I think it's wonderful. And as you said, it is, of all the jobs in the world, working for Nat Geo is not just a job, it is a joy.
Yes. Doesn't mean it's an easy joy, because it took me 5 years to get the pictures for my National Geographic magazine story and for this book. But to have that stage now, I couldn't be more excited that the Path of the Panther film is published and released on Nat Geo and Disney Plus and Hulu, and I couldn't be more excited that the Path of the Panther book is produced and published by National Geographic Books. So it's a great pride, and it's a great opportunity to share these stories with people all around the world.
Well, you've done a wonderful job with this, and I think that people will enjoy it. It's a great book. Father's Day is coming up. I hope that people will get it and give it as a Father's Day gift, because a Nat Geo book is always the perfect gift to give for any holiday, and particularly for Father's Day. This is one that I know fathers will love, and they will share with their families, and then we can all hope that we will have more than 200. What's your hope for the next few years? Do you think we'll have a nice increase in numbers?
It's going to be slow, but my hope is that panthers will continue moving further north in the state of Florida, into the northern Everglades, into the pine woods of central Florida and north Florida, and help reclaim that historic homeland, and that people will coexist and welcome them to do so. I hope that the book raises that profile, and I hope that people will connect with the story. Our organization has pathofthepanther.com, which is a great place to learn more about the book and the film, and also to take action and add your voice to support these causes.
Okay, so do a PSA for me, and I will play it here on Joy on Paper, because Carlton Ward Jr., I think this book is fantastic. It's called Path of the Panther, New Hope for Wild Florida. It's available online, and of course, you can go directly to National Geographic Books. It's a wonderful, wonderful website, and then everybody look for the film. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm sure it's fantastic and inspiring. And what you've done with this whole thing of protecting animals, and particularly protecting the panther, which is a beautiful, beautiful animal, I just want to applaud you, because you've done a wonderful job.
Thank you, Patsy. Thanks for sharing the story. Let me know what you think about the film once you see it on Disney Plus or Hulu.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
And then one day perhaps you'd like to come here to the studio. You let me know, and you can come here, and we can talk more, okay?
That sounds really good. Yeah, we're neighbors, and we'll keep telling the story. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye now. Bye. Wow, that's a great story. Wow. Yeah, you know, we can. My sister-in-law, she always opens the door in the morning, and she says, "What animal am I going to see?" And she's always hoping for deer, although she has opened the back door and screen door, and there's a bear sitting there. Anyway, remember what I always tell everyone. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book or books will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel. And perhaps for Carol J. Perry, I want them to do Haunted Haven Mysteries. That's set right here in my backyard, and she just finished her third book, and so it's just fantastic. She's a great writer. She writes 1,000 words a day, people. You can do it, too. All you have to do is get busy. Meanwhile, say something nice to somebody, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed. Boy, 3 guests today, so I was busy. Ooh, and so was Ed. And he saluted me. I saluted him. Everybody have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. It's going to be gorgeous, I think, all over the country. Get out there, smell the roses, smell the jasmine, and just be happy. Bye-bye now.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City
FM 102.3
WZHR Zephyr Hills
FM 104.3
Listen.
And a happy Thursday, Tampa Bay. Big Ed here on the Tantalk Radio Network. Let's take a look at your Bay Area forecast. Looking for a high this afternoon of 84 degrees. Partly cloudy skies, about a 20% chance of rain later on in the afternoon. Overnight low tonight of 72. And tomorrow's high also at 84. Sunset this evening is at 8:16. Now, here's the latest of CBS News.
CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Steve Kathan. Terror attack victims challenge social media, and the U.S. Supreme Court sidesteps an effort to hold those companies liable for letting militant groups.